Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and what's going on in our total environment, the health of our water, air, earth, communities, society, and the planet itself are the topics we discuss every week on Connect the Dots with different experts, authors, advocates, journalists. We're having a lot of journalists nowadays, writers, scientists, and analysts of all different kinds who are expert in different areas of our complex world. On today's show, I am delighted to welcome a returning guest whom we've had on a couple of times before, but probably not in the last year or so. He is Paul Blanche. He is a nuclear energy consultant who has worked with the Navy, with Westinghouse, where he was declared engineer of the year, as well as with power plants, and he's also, you know, advised and interacted with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the public agency that is there to assure that all safety regulations and requirements are met, so that this extremely dangerous, although also, you know, relatively clean in terms of its carbon output form of fuel, but which, you know, has a terrible, you know, has a waste problem and a whole bunch of other things, is actually operating in a way that is safe for the living. But his expertise is really in the details of how the plants function, how they are required to be safe, and all of that. And he's got decades of experience in these particular realms, and most recently gave a public symposium on this in New York State, talking to engineers about these topics. So I'm very delighted to welcome him back to Connect the Dots, and today we'll be discussing a topic that we've discussed on, you know, the prior occasions, which is the co-location, you know, the proximity of nuclear power plants with their tremendous risks of, meltdowns or harm or dysfunction in the proximity to natural gas pipelines, another form of energy which convey, you know, risks of explosions and the potential for negative synergy events. And so we're going to be discussing one particular location today on the show, but there are, you know, obviously this is something of concern as more pipelines crisscross our country and the globe itself. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Paul Blanche. I'm so happy to have you with us again today.
Thank you, Allison. And I can start off with, my overall perspective and maybe just to clarify some of my background. You failed to mention that I am a registered professional engineer in the state of California. Of course, I am an engineer. I am not opposed to nuclear power. I don't take a specific position on frack gas. My main concern is nuclear power and the safety of nuclear power. And my main concern is the Indian Point nuclear power plants located just 35 miles north of New York City and 10 miles north of the Tappan Zee Bridge, for those people who are familiar with it. And I've been working on this particular problem, that problem being the co-location of gas lines in the proximity of a nuclear power plant. And I've been working on this for almost 10 years while I was an expert witness for the state of New York Attorney General. And I've worked with the NRC in trying to get my arms around this problem. And I finally understand. I think I probably understand the problem more so than anyone in the world. And that includes the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I am going to make a very bold statement. And no one has been able to challenge or dispute the accuracy of the statement. And that statement is Indian Point, located again so close to New York City, is the most threatening, the most dangerous man-made facility in the United States and possibly the world. Again, that is a very, very bold statement. And I would like to say why I have come to that conclusion.
Yeah, that is very grim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have many industrial facilities, be it chemical plants, dams, highways, bridges, gas line wells, just gas lines, you know, a million miles of gas lines. A lot of man-made structures throughout this world, and even weapons factories, be it atomic weapons factories, chemical weapons factories, can't possibly do the damage that Indian Point would do should there be an accident. And I make that statement for two reasons. Number one, the damage is so great because of its proximity to New York City and Indian and the Hudson Valley. It's something like 20 million people. But that's the consequence should an accident occur. And again, should an accident occur, and I'll get into a little more detail, it certainly has the potential of being an accident similar to the Fukushima plant where three reactors melted down. The Indian Point reactors, the operating reactors, Units 2 and Unit 3, contain a lot more radioactive material, maybe 10 times more radioactive material within the plant capable of being released. In Fukushima, the primary wind direction was from the west to the east, and that being located on the east coast, 95% of the radiation blew out to sea and really didn't do a whole lot of harm to individuals. But if we look at the predominant winds from Indian Point, they run down the Hudson Valley toward New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, its location by itself is a problem, but when we get into co-locating gas transmission lines in the very proximity of Indian Point or a nuclear power plant, that increases the probability of an accident by many, many orders of magnitude, in fact, many thousands. And the probability of an accident is unacceptable. I've gone through, I've calculated various probabilities, and again, probabilities is more or less guesswork. But there's a relatively high probability, and that probability of this occurring is about, I use a number of 1 in 1,000 years. It sounds like a low number, but if we look at the probability of an airplane crash, it's 1 in 21 million per flight. That's a big difference between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 21 million. And if we look at the consequences of an airline crash, and I don't take lives lightly. I mean, I think the worst airplane crash was in the Canary Islands, and, you know, it was less than 1,000 people. That sounds like a lot. Indian Point, we're talking 20 million people impacted. I'm no way saying that we're going to have 20 million people dead, but impacted such that their lives have changed forever. Many people would be required to evacuate permanently. They may never be able to return to their residences. There is no insurance to cover their dislocation. My son happens to live there, and he and my grandkids could be dislocated, and his mortgage would continue even though he couldn't come within 20 miles of his house. Our government has no insurance. Now, why do I pick on Indian Point? I've mentioned separately the danger of a nuclear reactor, but I haven't, and I talked about the probability of an accident, but I haven't gotten into the specifics of the gas lines with respect to Indian Point. As a little bit of background, and I've done a lot of research on this, the International Atomic Energy Commission, which essentially provides safety guidance for all the world nuclear power plant, recommends that gas transmission lines be located anywhere from 7 to 10 kilometers from any nuclear facility. Mm-hmm. But we have Indian Point. We have gas lines, initial one put in 1952 and then some in 1962. And we got a big one going in this week, a 42-inch, 850-pound. These present a risk. The existing gas lines are located 380 feet from the control room of Unit 3. Should we get a leak there, and a leak and a fire, we don't even have to have a fire because the control room could be like the apartment in Harlem. It could just fill up with gas and blow up, and you're guaranteed a major meltdown. But if that doesn't happen and we have an explosion like San Bruno or Salem or Sissonville, West Virginia, we have a problem in that the analysis showed, and when I say analysis, I'm talking not the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's analysis, but an independent analysis that was done by three engineers, including myself, four, who have confirmed that should there be a gas line breach, accident, explosion, detonation, whatever you want to call it, the radius of the explosion could go out beyond 4,000 feet, which would engulf the entire nuclear power plant. And without a doubt, cause a meltdown. There is no doubt in my mind it would take away all AC power, which is was the cause of Fukushima. Without power, you don't have cooling. Without cooling, you have a meltdown. When you have a meltdown without power, you have a major release. And the situation was bad enough.
Let me comment here for a moment. I had been actually looking at some research recently done by a global foundation into assessments of global catastrophic risks, and they specifically differentiate between the various probabilities. You know, on the one hand, we have, you know, probably the signature and most significant overall risk, which is something we also cover a great deal in this program, is climate change. And that's something that, even though it's now rapidly moving ahead, is kind of an incremental risk that keeps on increasing. That is one kind of major risk. And, of course, catastrophic climate change and disruption of populations by climate change would be viewed as and is viewed in this research as, you know, the highest risk. But they also talk about things that suddenly function not in a sort of chronic until it gets so bad kind of fashion that, you know, the issue is terminal, if we use a kind of parallel to illnesses, or diseases that people might get, not a chronic problem, you know, that worsens, such as climate change, but actually a one-time you know, acute problem, like, you know, getting a horrible infection that no antibiotic will treat, or having an auto accident, or, you know, these are things that can suddenly take people out, that, you know, like an auto accident, there was no predicting that that might happen, and yet it can be quite deadly. And so we're talking here about something in the nature of an acute situation, you know, where it either happens in a moment, you know, or it doesn't. And yet we also, what you're describing, this is not just an event like an auto accident in which, you know, one or several people might die, or a plane accident, as you described, but this is actually an accident where, you know, 20 million people would be impacted, and a certain significant portion of those would die or be dislocated, contract illnesses as a result of the harmful exposure, of, you know, to radiation and all the rest of it. And so, in effect, it's a gamble, and the odds of, you know, whether or not this will occur, and the odds of the, you know, whether or not it will occur, what the odds are is really determined by, you know, the different safety controls and features that you're discussing and describing, you know, which is if the odds aren't, you know, if we don't have those things in place, the odds aren't good. If a blowout occurs and it's 10 miles from a nuclear power plant, then you're not in that same, you know, as close a risk zone. So what you're describing is a confluence of different circumstances that come together to increase the odds that this will actually happen, and produce the horrific impacts that you're describing, you know, with 20 million people affected, you know, and you're describing all the factors that are increasing that those odds and making this, you know, not only a possible catastrophe, but a, you know, but the odds weight toward it actually occurring. So it's not just a distant possibility that could never happen. Everything that you're talking about is are really different factors that increase the odds of its happening, of its being incredibly deadly and harmful, all of the whole sequence of events similar to what happened at Fukushima, and possibly worse because of the numbers of people involved. You know, this is, I mean, I, both as a, you know, an individual environmental reporter, along with my colleague Ellen Cantaro, have reported on this in an article called Fukushima on the Hudson. You know, this is called by the people in the area Fukushima on the Hudson because of these extremely uncomfortable parallels. And, you know, I'll let you continue a little bit more to describe the layout that you're, you know, that makes this so, makes this whole situation so vulnerable and unwise. And, you know, and then we'll take a, you know, a little pause, and I'll ask some more questions about how this is happening without people being concerned about it and without it being appropriately rendered safe or controlled in some way, if that's possible. So you were talking about that an explosion would actually cause a meltdown at, and, you know, we actually are hearing some industrial noise here in the background. I apologize. I hope what we're saying is still audible to people. You know, but and when you speak, I'm going to cover my phone because it's coming from my side. But, you know, what are the factors at Indian Point and in the pipeline that make this such a deadly combination?
Okay. Thanks very much for your insight. And, you know, getting back to the probability, everything we do in this world has a risk, but there's a risk and there's always a benefit associated with it. And certainly there's a benefit of nuclear power. But when we talk about risk and probability, there are, you know, certain events that whose probability is so low, we don't have to really concern ourselves. I am not concerned about a meteorite striking a nuclear power plant, the probability is just so low. The unintentional aircraft going into a nuclear power plant, the probability is so low. I can accept that. But when you start placing gas lines, and the biggest risk, I think, now that this is becoming known, is a terrorist. This whole situation, these pipes cross a road 200 feet from the nuclear power plant. We look at Oklahoma City and Ryder Truck. Very vulnerable, unprotected there. There are many ways a single terrorist could essentially destroy New York City and essentially destroy this country. I hate to publicize it, but I just can't get the attention it deserves. And the problem here is that both the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and PHMSA, Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Agency, have a requirement to do a risk assessment, and they have other regulations. They have absolutely refused to do any risk assessment. The state of New York has put out a contract to do a risk assessment. Nothing's been done. That was due 2 months ago. The politicians don't want to touch this. We're into a situation almost too big to fail. If you take the ultimate solution to this, it's there's two separate problems. Gas lines by themselves pose a problem to those people that are within a mile of it, but nuclear power, separate thing, poses a risk to those people that are located 50 to 100 miles. When you take the combination of the two, it's a deadly mixture. And I just want to give people an idea of what would happen, how much gas flows through these pipelines. And these are numbers I have from the industry. And should there be a break in the new pipeline, the amount of gas that flows out of there is equivalent to about a million pounds of TNT per minute. And this continues for 30 minutes to 30 hours. I mean, it just we don't know. And I'm not saying it's going to blow up like an atomic bomb or even detonation. It's going to either migrate into areas where it could explode, or it could be a jet fire like San Bruno or Salem, Pennsylvania, that would scorch the earth out a few thousand feet and essentially do the same. There are many mechanisms of damage to the nuclear power plant should you have an explosion. And again, the initial line was put in there in 1952. It's aging. What is the most frustrating thing to me is that we have clear requirements, and if we would follow the federal requirements, both the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and FERC and PHMSA, to do a proper risk assessment, the co-location of these two projects would not be allowed. However, our agencies,
so they haven't done a risk assessment because they don't want to uncover the problems, because by their own regulations, which they are already required to follow and are not following, but by those regulations, if they did a risk assessment and all of this were reinforced or reexamined, then what would have to happen? They would have to close the plant, they would have to withdraw the pipeline, like, which is already built and ready to go, as far as I can understand. What are the implications? Why don't they do a risk assessment?
Well, it's not only why don't they, why doesn't our federal government require them to do it? Because the federal law clearly states, and I have filed Freedom of Information Act requests, that's why I can say they haven't done it. If they did a true, transparent, independent risk assessment, they would find that locating those gas lines in a high population zone, and especially near a nuclear power plant, would be totally unacceptable. So we're in a catch-22. They can't comply with the regulations. They can't comply with the risk assessment. And there are many, many other areas of the regulations that they refuse to comply with. And they have signed a document. This is Spectra Energy, the company that's building it. They will be in compliance with all the requirements of, you know, XX regulation. They are not, and we've had many conversations with the regulatory agencies. They absolutely refuse it. But here's another very, very important point that we think the Governor Cuomo is on our side. The state has been, the state of New York Public Service Commission has a memorandum of understanding agreement between Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Agency and the state of New York, where the state of New York has the clear responsibility to assure regulatory compliance and safe operation. Our governor, I'm sorry, the New York governor, he's not mine, thank God, has the ability to tell his agencies to do an inspection to assure compliance with the regulations. That's all he has to do. He could do that today. He will not do it. I have been questioning Cuomo's motivations since when I was working for him back in 2008 with respect to the gas lines. He didn't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. I won't even speculate as to why he knows he has the power but refuses to do anything and refuses to protect New York State and 20 million people and the rest of the country. He has the absolute power to do it, and he knows it, and he won't do it. He'll give you the right words, but he will not do anything.
Well, the same has been true. You know, we've had our senator, Charles Schumer, who is now about to become the Democratic minority leader and in the coming Trump administration. And nationally, Democratic Party, you know, people in the Democratic Party are looking to Schumer and mentioning we'll have to get Schumer to do this and we'll have to be getting Schumer to do that. And, you know, I can say with great confidence, because I've been at numerous of these rallies and gatherings and press conferences launched by you know, Resist AIM and SAPE and some of the other advocacy groups in New York State who organized around this, that, you know, in the same way the governor and the senator, you know, give lip service and actually don't really take that added step forward. I think, you know, right now we have a president and an incoming administration completely populated with people who are going to be amping up even further fossil fuel use and therefore moving the dial toward catastrophic climate change, you know, rapidly coming onward. You know, and one would like to say that there is a white knight in this political landscape, but, you know, it's really hard to come by in a context where money and politics governs everything. And, you know, these powerful industries, and I know the plant, you know, you don't focus on this aspect, Paul, but, you know, the Indian Point plan, with all of its long record of safety problems, is heavily subsidized by New York State taxpayers. And I think these elected officials, they, you know, they look to these industries that are kind of on the public dole while claiming to be leaders and imperatives in our world, you know, and they fund, you know, the politicians who run and people, the politicians of, sad to say, of both stripes and both parties are just completely rendered, either they're, you know, kind of buying on cavalierly because they don't care and they just want to make as much money as possible before the planet goes down, or, you know, they care, but they can't really stand up by their caring in our, you know, blue democratic state with all of our democratic officials elected. And you know, and this has been, as you point out, and this has been a really bitter pill in terms of the faith of myself, the reporter, but many, many other people in seeing the operation of the two-party system where both, you know, each side portrays the other as being a devil, and I could, you know, take a side in that discussion, but really that isn't doing anything to deliver actual intervention and action on these critical concerns, so long as, you know, these political figures look not to our future of living beings on Earth, but they look to their own short-term political future, they look to their own long-term financial profit, and they say, what works for me, you know? So, you know, we're in the position of liking, trusting, voting for, holding our nose and voting for, the only option that we have to vote for, are figures who are caught up in this web of greed and coercion and corruption. And to me, you know, climate change is a long range example. It's not that long range, and the range keeps moving closer. But you know, this is like an imminent risk to the economy of the entire country, to, you know, for people who don't care about the 20 million people, to this major population center. You know, this is like a no starter, and yet it grinds on, and we get lip service but no real movement because of these vested parties. So, you know, on the one hand, going out and about and reporting on energy and environment and also food and health as I do from an advocacy and policy perspective, I hear a lot of people hopefully saying, well, technology will solve our problems. Well, you know, here we have examples of technology that have been developed, and they have tremendous downside risks. So, you know, when you have someone investing in something or profiting in something, they don't really want to look at those risks, you know, or even if we're part of the community that's getting its energy from the plant, which is in fact the case for people in the New York region and elsewhere. But, you know, we have to look at that because it's otherwise we're actually gambling. This is Russian roulette.
You're right. It is. You know, we always, and I've been thinking about this a lot, we look for short-term benefits and always forget about the long-term effects. I used to smoke. I never thought about long-term effects. We look at drugs. We look at sex. We look at everything we do in our lives, and it's always for the short-term benefit, and rarely does anyone look at the long-term impacts, and that's the same thing here. We have Wall Street. We have the energy companies and so on and so forth looking at the short-term gains. What can I do? What can I do for my shareholders? We've had, you use a good word, lip service. We've had lip service from Gillibrand and Schumer and some of the other congresswomen people. But there are two people who have done everything in their power, and that is Congresswoman Nita Lowey. Met with her on a few occasions, and Sandy Galef, who's the assemblywoman for the area for the state of New York. But they alone don't have the power to do anything. There's only two people in my mind, as I'm sitting here thinking, that have the power to do something now. And neither of them will do anything. First one is Governor Cuomo. He could do it today. He could issue stop work. We're going to verify that this thing is built in compliance with the regulations. He could do that 10 minutes from now. He won't do it. We have the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, whom I've met with on a couple of occasions. He could say right now, and he knows it, I've faced him right across the table, that this is unsafe. He could say, I've relooked at Paul Blanch's calculations and those of many other engineers, and this is unsafe. We have to withdraw our approval. Those are the only two people that I can think of off the top of my head that can stop this, unless something unforeseen happens. God, hope it doesn't, but it's been, you know, a very frustrating battle by me, and I don't have anything to gain. Certainly, I don't get paid for anything I do. It's just been total frustration that we can't get the attention that this deserves. And not that I'm giving up, but boy, am I getting frustrated. So.
Yeah, that is. You know, what do they do? Just sort of shuffle the pieces around? They involve you in a kind of bureaucratic war of words? Or, you know, what is it actually that people are telling you? Because I know you voluminously document everything, you know, that you're stating on this show. It is all scientifically documented. And I've seen your documentation over and over, and it's been
right.
The basis for my own reporting. What do they say in response to that?
Well, they always come back, as any politicians do, with very evasive answers. Like, if I ask PHMSA, which I have, for a copy of the risk assessment required, the response is, well, we believe that Spectra, the owner of the pipeline, has done it, and we have the ability to go in anytime and look at that risk assessment. Now, what kind of an answer is that? Have they done it or have they not done it? It's a typical political response from this politician Karen Gentile at PHMSA. Those are the kind of responses that we get. Well, we believe they're in compliance. We just, you know, sometimes we'll go in and look and verify. I mean, the other thing is, one of the clear requirements is to make the public aware of the risk. I mean, you have a school 400 feet away, a church, a library, residents whose lives are at risk. They are supposed to educate the public as to the risk, and they are also, and this is a federal requirement, they are also supposed to assure that the local first responders, be it firefighters, hospitals, and so on and so forth, are prepared to deal with an event. It just hasn't been done. There are hundreds of regulations that our government just ignores, and unless we get major media attention, it will go on, and, you know, we'll hope for the best.
Well, you know, that puts it, I actually can also anecdotally confirm what you've just said, because I happen to be speaking about this in a location where somebody who was a first responder in that region happened to be present. And she was like, you know, we know nothing about this. We have a little plan. We're all going to get in a line. And like, you know, in the 50s, when school children held hands and walked out on the street. And, you know, this is what, you know, which is what was the sort of nuclear drill or fire drill, you know, as if you could just have the time to, you know, kind of get your coat on and line up and walk out the door. And that's the kind of thing they're practicing. Of course, it's completely inadequate. And, you know, your whole hope to get major media attention, you know, when we did the piece in Tom Dispatch, Fukushima on the Hudson, it was right in the time of the New York primary. And actually, candidate Bernie Sanders at the time immediately responded, calling, you know, for the closing of the plant. Hillary Clinton responded, saying, "Oh, they have to be better regulated." And mind you, I mean, she lives within, I think, 7 miles or something of this location.
Yeah.
You know, that is as if, you know, the activists and neighbors in the area had not been going every legal and agency appeal route or testimony route that, you know, could possibly, you know, be done for several years. And, of course, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which oversees the pipeline, is a quasi-governmental agency, so they're not really they're fully accountable to the government, even though they're, you know, supposedly a government agency that is empowered through Dick Cheney's adjustment of the 2005 energy bill to approve all pipelines. Their actual funding comes from industry. Their alliance and sense of beholding is to industry. And, you know, you can basically say anything to them. And you know, there was recently a hearing in Washington, D.C., and there's a lot of brilliant online testimony about this from some of the thought leaders in this area. And, you know, they just go la, 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 and it's like they didn't hear you, and that will be it. And in terms of major media attention, I have the, you know, distinction of having written one of the first national media articles on this back in 2015, and it was published on Alternet, and got a lot of notice there. I spent weeks interviewing you, interviewing other pipeline safety experts, talking to local officials, and working on this article, and I literally, you know, reporters are supposed to be objective, but when you see this happening in your patch, you know, in a way that would influence, you know, our beloved city and all its residents and all the many different kinds of diverse humans who live here, and no one is paying attention to it, you know, it's actually, you have to write objectively and nail down every fact, but it's extremely natural to feel deep concern and grief and shock and puzzlement and anger over, you know, the willingness to subject this risk, you know, all these people to this risk because of the fear and the entanglement and corruption with these wealthy industries. And at that time, after, you know, I had all of the material transcribed and I was editing it, I thought, you know, it would be so much better if a major outlet like Newsweek or the New York Times were to publish this. I would happily give away my time to give all of this content to a reporter from one of these outlets so that they could, you know, more people could know. And I approached my colleagues in, you know, certain publications, and I was basically, you know, I was basically told, oh, it's not a national story, you know. It's a local story that the Westchester newspapers should be thinking about. And, of course, I was told the same when I went out as the first reporter to cover fracking, when I also, the same thing repeated itself when I began reporting on the trade agreements and their terrific impacts on climate, which I began doing in 2014. I did exactly the same thing with a national media figure. And in all cases, there's just this either dead silence or, you know, the people are gracious and you get this code response. It's a local story. Having been on the inside of the media, I know what that means. That means we all know this is a no-no. We won't be covering this. There are things that we will or won't cover, things we will and won't say. If it's, and, you know, all of these areas that I've covered happen to fall into that. So by the time it was happening in the presidential campaign, I'd already seen it. When you look, you know, for years, and if you look at, because I've been reporting on these issues for 9 years, but if you look at who owns the media and who influences the media and who they're currying favor with and entree with and everything else, if the public officials want this to keep, you know, nuclear, this to keep limping along, if they, you know, are funded by the gas and oil or pipeline industries, if they have uranium deals they're making with Russia or whatever they're doing, you know, then they don't want this to be out there for citizens to know about, and the citizens themselves don't really want to know about it. They just want to kind of feel good that they like this candidate or not another. They don't, you know, most people, you know, it's all too complex for them, so they kind of don't even have the basic media literacy skills that are needed to sort of know, you know, that people we like and elect could not be worthy of our trust on either side of the political spectrum. And that's the situation that we're in, you know, with these deadly technologies, as people look at the political system and shake their head and go, well, maybe there's a technological fix. So
there is none.
Right.
So I just, again, my frustrations, and, you know, I think about, you know, everything, fracking, climate change, nuclear. And someone said to me, don't worry, Paul, the Earth will survive. Of course, us inhabitants might not survive, but the Earth will survive.
Right. I mean, basically, yeah, I mean, I think we realistically, and it's really hard to do as our, you know, the structure of our civilization is still intact and working either well or quite marginally, or in some cases not at all, for, you know, for a lot of people. It's really hard to, you know, that's an unimaginable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But getting these folks to pay attention, I mean, I think the only time the New York Times covered this issue was when our article, which may have played a role in the response of the two candidates, you know, saying what they felt about this, and then the New York Times, you know, covered that, and they've never gone back to covering it since. At the time, I was very much hoping that that, you know, issue would come to what was at the time the imminent Democratic primary in New York State. But, you know, of course, the same media players from CNN and everywhere else that doesn't cover this were hosting those conversations, determining what the questions were, whom to softball, give more time to, you know, when to throw a sort of semi-hardball question, you know, in a given direction, what they were up to. And so obviously they who have not covered this would not be interested in breaking their media blackout and covering it. So we didn't hear anything about that. And, you know, so, I mean, more and more people are getting educated and understanding as problems with pipelines, you know, become more and more paramount and of national focus, that, you know, we need to change our media habits too. And unfortunately, the mainstream reaches the most people, but it's only the, you know, the bought politicians that are going to be getting a voice in that very often. And you know, that's the sad truth. People really need to develop other ways of getting information. You know, I know it's not your area to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline because you're a nuclear expert as opposed to a pipeline expert, although, you know, with your incredible engineering and scientific background, you probably understand more about pipelines than, you know, a lot of other people. I mean, do you have any particular take or view on Dakota Access and the whole battle there, because that has certainly raised the profile on the fact that pipelines are, you know, very troublesome.
Yeah, well, that again is not a natural gas pipeline. That's an oil pipeline, and mm-hmm. Yes, there is risk. There is risk associated with that, and that risk is the contamination of land, contamination of water supplies, rivers, and so on. So forth, and there's also the question of, you know, the indigenous people, national sovereignty. I don't think the risk is anywhere near what we're talking about. Certainly, I support the opposition because the government is just steamrolling them. But as far as overall risk to the environment, to the people, it's certainly quite a bit different in Dakota or Keystone than what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I just, you know, I'm sitting here at my desk, and I've got framed the front page of the Wall Street Journal from 1997, and with my pen and ink sketch of me above the fold on the Wall Street Journal, and, you know, I've had Time magazine cover, and, you know, New York Times. The media has changed. from the mid-90s to now. I mean, and that's the only thing that saved me and got what I needed to get back in the 90s when I fought my battle was the media. Times have changed, and we're not getting it. I mean, I've got these cartoons, these satirical cartoons in the Hartford Courant, Boston Globe. Just don't have that. And it's not because I haven't tried. And I'll keep trying, but I'm very, very discouraged. I mean, the only thing that would get the attention is, you know, if we have a major accident, God knows none of us wants to see that. How do you get the attention? Maybe I fly a drone in there with a note on the bottom and land it on top of the gas line next to the control room and say, bang. I'd wind up in jail, but I'd get the attention. But that's how vulnerable this thing is.
Are there other comparable situations in the United States where if this one goes through, we'll be seeing more of this?
No. There's a situation down in south of Miami where gas pipelines are in the proximity, but smaller gas lines. There's a big danger, but they're not adding to it, and they're not supplying interstate gas from Pennsylvania, New York, through right next to a nuclear power plant. So there is nothing comparable. If you look, there's a lot of nuclear power plants down in the southeast, but all the gas transmission lines are many, many miles away. I mean, they've shut down facilities in New Mexico because one was 1.8 miles away from not a nuclear power plant, but a nuclear waste processing facility, and they disallowed that. Well, that didn't have financial impact that this would have. They know it. They're wrong. I'm not afraid to call them a bunch of liars, but I don't know. It's frustration at its worst, but I keep trying to do some things. So anyway,
we have another 6 minutes or so. Wow, we've got a little background noise there. Oh my goodness. I think you have to turn that off.
No, I don't have to.
Or turn the sound down there. What about the whole argument, we need to undergo this tremendous risk because we need the energy. What's your view of that?
Oh, I don't believe that we need the energy. There are certainly alternatives. I'm sorry about this interruption here. There's no one else to take the other phone calls. Could you repeat your question?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I mean, one of the rationales that people make for the, ongoing existence, of Indian Point with this pipeline coming through is the argument that we need the energy. Well, we have to, and I mean, the most typical thing people say, of course, is, the absurd statement, I need gas for my car. That's not actually what we're talking about. We're talking about electrical power, home heating, and all the rest of it. I mean, in your view, what would happen if either the plant were closed or the pipeline were shut down or both in terms of our energy needs?
I
know this is not your specific area, but...
Well, no, I certainly look at it, but if a pipeline were shut down, and I'm talking existing plus a new pipe, if the new pipeline didn't go in, I don't think there'd be any big impact on the energy supply because most of it's going for export to Canada, overseas, and so on and so forth. If you shut down the existing pipelines and tried to reroute it, it's my personal belief that our energy prices, our natural gas prices here in New England would go up considerably. The shutdown of Indian Point, I think that power could be easily replaced. We wouldn't have extended blackouts or anything like that. We would have a shortage, maybe some brownouts for a while, but quickly solar power is becoming so cheap and conservation, we would get through the 2,000 megawatts that we wouldn't have from Indian Point. There's been a lot of studies, and there's power available. But again, it's a double-edged sword. Where's that power coming from? It's going to be coming from, you know, gas-fired, coal-fired, oil-fired plants, increasing CO. So it's not a straightforward problem. But Indian Point could be shut down. Those gas lines could be shut down. One big inconvenience to a lot of people, but it could be done.
Well, that's good to know. And, you know, so what are your, you know, what was the response to your recent presentation? I mean, are a lot of people interested in this? Do you see more public engagement around it? Are you getting the ears of others in the academic community, you know, and with other voices joining in? Like, what's happening with that?
I'm underwhelmed that I was very disappointed at the lack of attendance we had at RPI. Specifically, it was a bad time of the year. Students are in final exams. They've gone home. Maybe wasn't publicized properly, but I was extremely disappointed by the lack of attention by local media, students, professors, politicians. It was right in the Albany area. Again, that's part of my frustration. Trying everything. And I'm frustrated. I'm sorry. I thought I had someone at the door here. So, yeah, the danger is there. I'm doing my best. And not sure what else I can do.
I mean, what you're describing, which is also what we experienced in the, you know, in the recent election and its outcome, is that, you know, there's a kind of deadlock in this country, and, you know, what people need, you know, is it's not easily heard, it's not easily acted upon. I think people, in voting for Trump, or just voting for change, and, you know, maybe not really that clear what kind of change that would mean. It's, you know, maybe become more clear as time passes and everything. And certainly understandable why people would feel the need for that, because in so many areas, like, there's a deadlock. And yet many people are not kind of feeling the pain, or not yet in an afflicted community. So there's a whole other population where they're just kind of standing by. There may be many people in New York State who are in the at-risk zone who don't even know about it. I was speaking to somebody who is a long-time, you know, green lifestyle, you know, lead consultant kind of person, living within, you know, 10, 15 miles of the Indian Point site, and not at all aware that this was going on. And when I mentioned it, it was like, oh, well, that's always been there. I'm sure it'll be fine, you know.
Yeah, wow. That's the attitude. How do we change that attitude? Yeah.
If we had a valid
risk assessment that had the credibility that they're supposed to do, and would acknowledge the risk, that's why they're not doing it, because the risk is so great. They can't do it. It would cause too much turmoil. That's why I'm getting so much pushback on the risk assessment, be it from the governor or from the state's agents or from the federal agencies. They can't do it, you know?
So it's like,
yeah,
we better just keep our head in the sand.
Started off my morning on a bad. Pardon?
I started out your morning. This is your topic. You started out my morning. No, I'm just kidding. But
I know.
You know, I mean, I have many topics, and this is one of them. But, you know, what people can do is go to the Facebook page of Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion, the SAPE project. Join that page to get notifications of actions and updates about what's going on with all of this. You know, talk to people about it. Like, everybody sort of is cruising, like, you know, we're having a nice time. You can also go online to SAPE216.org and follow their actions, contribute. Resist AIM is another group organizing around this. And, you know, I mean, when I see the demonstrations in front of Charles Schumer's office, even though he doesn't come down, the numbers of people and the voices of concern are rising, and, you know, we'll see what, you know, if anything can be done. So we're here at the end of our time here in Connect the Dots. I just want to thank you so much, Paul Blanche, for being with me today on the show. And thank you for the years and years of expertise, commitment, you know, stubbornness, persistence. You know, you're really a model advocacy person that, you know, who started out in a field and became a whistleblower. And, you know, all honor and gratitude to you for your terrific work in protecting us. And thank you for being with me again on the show. And, you know, hope we have a breakthrough this year as 2017 approaches. Thank you.
I hope so. Well, I appreciate your time and your listeners' time, and we'll keep working on it. Thanks again,
Alice. We will. Sure. Thank you. And thank you, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Ooh, well.